if the governance and policy is not good, the procyclicality happens, right? Procyclical fiscal expansions, high inflation, and also less savings and investments, and all of the mining-driven revenues are flowing into the consumption, temporary consumption. And also the real effective exchange rate efficiency, which deteriorates the non-mining sector competitiveness, etc. So we, in the past 15 years, we had experienced two significant boom-bust cycles, and apparently we are in a third expansionary cycle. But what we have learned, 10 years ago during the global financial and economic crisis, we killed the economy. Why? Because of the wrong policy, macro-policy mix. At that time, we had a significant exogenous shock, deterioration of terms of trade and collapse of the foreign direct investments. And then the threat was actually declining broad money. If we allow broad money substantial shrinkage, then there would be a short-term credit crunch into the banking industry and immediately translate into the real sector and losing thousands of jobs. That happened 10 years ago. And then the ultimate very bad result was actually 9% real GDP growth contracted by 1.3% within 12 months. This was the very wrong policy mix due to the traditional orthodox macroeconomic policies like austerity, tightening, everything. Same thing happened starting from 2012, 6 years ago. I had a new job at the central bank as a chief economist and advisor to the government. And we actually structured a new way to mitigate that exogenous shock. And the exogenous shock was four times larger and deeper than the previous shock. And this was actually estimated as 60% equivalent to nominal GDP. And what was our response? Instead of tightening everything, instead of allowing a significant decline of net domestic credits, we actually made monetary injections into the real sector through the banking industry. We didn't lend any single penny to the government budget, but we lent directly to the commercial banks for the targeted programs, including middle-class savings program, like housing mortgages, programs against supply-driven inflation, because in a seasonal economy, supply shock always happens, and it always creates lots of pressures and inflation. And also protecting the labor market and enabling the economic structural reforms after the commodity super cycle. So ultimately, it worked, and the overall monetary injections that central bank made was over 20% equivalent to GDP. The economy was losing lots of blood, but someone needed to inject the blood, right? So it was the central bank that we did. So ultimately, what happened after this unconventional monetary policy was inflation reduced from 14% to 2%. And then banking sector remained resilient and stable with adequate capital adequacy ratios and also high liquidity ratios and NPL around 8 to 9% compared to the previous crisis, it was two times less. Third one was actually the current external current account deficit was significantly declined from 20% equivalent to GDP to less than 5%. So this was actually the so-called, we called these policy measures as a economic soft landing rather than economic crush landing that we did 10 years ago. So this was actually the experience that I witnessed, and but we were doing that policies as intuitively, and then we recognized that this is actually a part of very coherent and related to the MMT concept. So that's why I really needed to share this pragmatic experience with all of you. Thank you.
budgeting and finance in the School of Public and Environmental Affairs at Indiana University, which is probably the highest ranked school you've never heard of. According to U.S. News and World Report, our MPA program is ranked number one in the country. And to give you some idea of the crowd in which we run, the Harvard Kennedy School is number four. We have 100 full-time faculty. We have 500 full-time master's students, 170 PhDs, 3,000 undergraduate majors. It's a going concern. And so I'm going to give you a kind of an educator's perspective on all of this. Our administration historically has not believed that our students need to learn anything about macroeconomics because they're going to become just pure technocrats. So they take a basic course in the economics of the firm, essentially managerial economics. I've been teaching public budgeting and finance in this program. I've been doing it for about 20 years, all told. And I have found that as we express most of our work in monetary terms, we never actually talk about money. We've never been talking about how government actually spends and taxes operations, procedurally, administratively, through the banking system. I haven't really talked about what the effects are. We make no distinction between hard and soft budget constraints at the federal or the subnational level. It's really kind of disheartening, you know, when I think back at what I didn't know, you know, 20 years ago about MMT and what I've learned since then. I feel somewhat subversive in incorporating these things into my classes at this point. And that's actually kind of important, getting to the point that was made earlier about educating technocrats and mid-level bureaucrats who will go forward and be receptive to these ideas, at least have the receptors out there. We have a direct pipeline, it seems. Many of our graduates end up at CBO, at OMB, at the GAO, and various other agencies in Washington. And if they don't go into those agencies, they end up with some of the big consulting firms, but ultimately after 3 or 4 years, they cycle out into a federal agency of one sort or the other. The idea is to get them to think differently about the way the world actually works. And I can't say at this point, I haven't made up my mind whether the students that come to me are, I'm better off getting them because they've never had any experience and background in economics, so I can teach them right, or if you really want to get the ones that have had an undergraduate degree, or perhaps in prior graduate work in economics, so that I can, you know, take the world and turn it upside down right in front of their faces. And it's, you know, the cognitive dissonance, the grimace on their face as they think through the implications of what this actually means. And then they try to poke holes in it and they find that they can't. It's really quite amusing in many respects. But I'm not trying to inflict sort of mental torture on my students. Instead, I'm trying to get them outside of their comfort zone to think that there might be an alternative way of ordering and structuring the economic universe in which we operate, so that when they go out there, whether they actually believe me or not, doesn't matter. I just need to get them to doubt that what they've been taught is the whole truth. And so this is sort of what I've been all about, and I'll stop right there.
Please feel free to stand if you have any questions, or if you'd like to see your own put your hand.
Yeah, sorry, if you want to jump up as well, we can grab you another seat, right? We can stop.
I have nothing to add with respect to the promotion of MMT as an attack on the historic austerity paradigm. I think that you know, I was immediately persuaded of that when I was asked to review Randy's 1990s book for the publisher, because I had previously published on job guarantees. I asked her, hey, you know, I had the eureka moment immediately. But that expertise doesn't necessarily translate to the design of job creation programs or of a job guarantee. And so I don't want to talk about promoting MMT, which I think they've said what needs to be said. I want to observe that in promoting the job guarantee, there are other traditions and sources of knowledge out there that have to be included in the discussion. And I acknowledge that I have been guilty of not doing that, because I was an early player in the legislative game there, as advising Representative John Conyers in the design of his full employment bill, H.R. 1000, back in 2013. But by 2017, I'd come to the realization that this process has to be more inclusive. And I admit that I didn't reach out to the MMT crowd then, but I did reach out to Sandy Darity to get him and Derek Hamilton involved in advising Representative Connors. Now, unfortunately, they went to a lot of effort in developing a set of proposals for revisions to the bill, and then Representative Connors or his staffers, I suspect it was the staffers, made the decision, we're not going to revise it this session of Congress, because every time we revise a bill, you got to go around and explain to all the co-sponsors what's changed. And it's easier just to stick it back in the hopper, and then you can count on the co-sponsors signing on again. And there had been an erosion of co-sponsors because of the loss of progressives in Congress. And so while we had 59 co-sponsors back in 2013, we're down to 29 now, not because we lost any of the sponsor co-sponsors we had then, just they're not in Congress anymore. So I just want to emphasize that while I am gung-ho in support of all of the work that is being done in advocating MMT as an attack on austerity politics, I hope that we can come together and work more collaboratively in our work with the members of Congress or state and local officials in promoting the job guarantee and working on job guarantee legislation. And I think that there are concrete steps that we can and should take. If we could get on the same page, that would be great. But I don't think we have to be on the same page, because one of the things I learned in the process of advising Representative Connors, you advise, but in the end of the day, they're the ones who decide what goes into the bill. And if you haven't persuaded them, it's not going to be in there. So not everything I wanted got in, and some of the things I wanted to come out didn't come out. So I think that we can ensure that when we do speak with legislators, that we tell them, look, there are other folks that you ought to talk to. And we suggest that they be brought into the discussion. They have some different ideas than we do, but we want you to have the options and understand the arguments for and against any particular option as we go forward. The worst thing in the world will be to have competing advocacies of the job guarantee or competing job guarantee bills to dilute the important work of building a common base of support for the job guarantee idea. I know that John Conyers, who was the sponsor of the Medicare for All Act originally, so he was the guy who put that on the table. And his idea is, look, I know this isn't going to get passed, but what I want to do is to create something that progressives can rally around. And it worked then, and that's what he wanted to do with H.R. 1000. This isn't going to pass, but I want to create something that progressives can rally around. Well, it'll be more helpful if we can have one thing for progressives to rally around rather than competing for progressive support for three things. So that's all I have to say.
If you'd like to respond internally, that's fine, and we'll go to
I'd like to just make a comment to follow up with that. One of the things that's important that I felt was important for the community, hopefully, to be aware of is that there already is a lot of infrastructure already established in the rural community because of the long development of the extension program and the land grant universities. And I think to the extent that people who are working on the jobs guarantee can leverage that and those resources, that would be really very helpful, especially because these are people who actually really know those communities very well. They know what they're about, what is needed, but they may not always be necessarily the easiest communities, but they could be very, very helpful if we can bring them on board as well. So.
Thanks.
Sure, next question. And again, if you have just thoughts in general, people have experience that's relevant to this conversation, please feel free to join.
Hi, Nick Estes. Earlier this week, there was an article in the New York Times, and the headline I know said, the interest on the national debt is now going to be greater, or soon going to be greater than all the spending for defense. And it went on and on about what a horrible thing that was. When I talk to a progressive think tank, friends of mine who are in think tanks in DC, and I try to explain that worrying about the deficit is probably not the most appropriate thing we should be doing, other more important things to think about. One of the comebacks I always get is this issue that the interest on the debt is going to be so large that as a political matter, it's going to crowd out other worthwhile things in the federal budget. And and it's not enough, I found, to tell them, well, we're basically just raising money from one way and giving it back to society in another way. It's kind of, that's, you know, we're paying interest back to Americans and so forth. But they'll say, well, that may be true, but it's a political matter. The size of these interest payments are a killer and crowd out other stuff that the progressives would like to do. So I just like your response to that. Anybody who, I suspect Dr. Kelton might want to weigh in, but whoever would like to say a few words about how we counter that. And one technical question is, would it make any sense for the, if we could do it, for the Federal Reserve to buy more of the national debt? So that the interest payments will be made from the Treasury to the Fed, and the Fed will just rebate them. So is that a possible way of approaching this? Thanks.
Well, you're right that it's a major preoccupation among lawmakers. That line item in the budget comes up all the time. It came up all the time during my time on the Budget Committee for the exact reason that you suggest. They view as somewhat static the total amount of money that the government will be spending year on year, $4.3 trillion budget. And they don't really want to increase the size, so one way to respond to the concern that the interest on the national debt is going to outstrip what we're spending on defense is just to simply say, so why don't you budget more money for defense? And it won't be bigger than the defense budget, right? You can pass any budget you want. You can put additional resources into education, infrastructure, defense, or whatever the case is. So that's one way to go about it. By the way, I've got a piece percolating for Bloomberg on exactly this topic, where I go through a number of ways to respond to this question about interest on the debt. Another way, where's Bill Mitchell? Is he here? So Bill has long advocated just simply allowing all of the outstanding treasuries to mature and don't issue anymore. Because if you view interest as a subsidy, right, which it is, then you say, why are we doing this? What is the economic reason for selling bonds in the first place and for paying a subsidy to bondholders in the form of interest income? Why don't we just not issue treasuries? And over a period of years, the national debt will be eliminated, and there will be no interest on the debt. So that's the way Bill Mitchell would respond. You said, why not the central bank? This is what Japan has largely been doing, right? And so, yes, the Fed could put more and more treasuries on its own balance sheet, but you'd still have that line item. You'd still have interest on the debt. So there would still be kind of that political concern. And I have one more that I've been doing in Bloomberg News that I don't remember what it is, but I think you should speak to it.
There's a number of ways to think about that. One is, every time someone has mentioned, you know, the size of the treasury market, the debt, the interest, I'm always like, you know, as a former treasury official, I'll be like, it's the wonder of the financial world. It is something that makes U.S. capital markets extraordinarily strong and vibrant. And I've heard Stephanie make this point of, you don't like the debt, does that mean you don't like the treasury market? And every public official shies away from saying they don't like the treasury market because it is something other countries have tried to emulate, and very few have been able to actually get that type of market and its functionality and all its wonderful uses in place. The second thing is to some degree to what the, you know, how you describe the Federal Reserve and their purchases of treasuries. Stephanie's right, you can look to the Bank of Japan. That's had a very aggressive program. But additionally, what happens is with the treasuries that the Fed owns, the interest that's paid to the Fed eventually gets rebated back to the Treasury Department, less some theoretical number for IOER. So basically what's happened is when the Fed buys these treasuries, it's converted all these fixed rate securities into like a floating rate security, but that doesn't come off nicely in a nice bite-sized sentence. So it does happen in a way that interest payment is regulated, and you'll actually see, if you look at a budget statement, this rebate that comes back from the Fed. And you can almost offset it, you know, at times against what's coming in from, you know, what the proposed interest calculations would be. The other thing is I don't know if this is the foreign interest calculations on the debt are actually not particularly accurate. I just want that to be known. Like, it's a very, like, theoretical exercise in what those calculations are. So when people, you know, obsess about what they're supposed to be, I tell them, like, you're talking about a number that has to be reported because of budget rules, but it also is not necessarily calculated in a way that you should have a huge amount of confidence in. So like, there's a number of takes to this. I wish there was a bite-sized way of just of dealing with it, but I actually don't.
I mean, the other MMT response from people like Warren and Randy and Bill over a period of many years has been, why don't we just have permanent zero or very nearly zero interest rate policy? And so that's another way to go about, you know, avoiding the kinds of projections that CBO and others are doing when they say, you know, this is going to be the impact on the debt ratio over time, because it presumes that the Fed is going to continue tightening and so forth, and so you get that interest expense going higher and higher. So the, you know, some MMTers have argued you simply prevent that by telling the Fed you don't raise rates, right? You know, you anchor the overnight interest rate at something very close to zero, and you leave it there. It's a poor tool for the purposes of micromanaging or fine-tuning the economy anyway. So let's just anchor it and leave it alone. That's another way to
I'd like to suggest another incremental approach to the issue. I think that there are strong political reasons to link social welfare benefits to funding arrangements that reinforce the sense of entitlement of workers to those benefits. One of the teachings of you know, behavioral economics that we do need to pay attention to is that the way in which things are experienced has an affirmative economic effect in the way people value those things. There is the famous example of FDR in responding to a question about wasn't it stupid to, you know, impose payroll taxes to pay for Social Security benefits. And the response was, well, that was all politics. The reason we did that was to make sure that no damn politician could ever take my Social Security benefits away. And I think that those political reasons speak for linkages between social welfare benefits in particular and funding that might not be appropriate in other areas of government. And with respect to the job guarantee, the way I've tried to take advantage of MMT theory in thinking about it is, look, I want a funding source that does what Roosevelt wanted it to do. On the other hand, I know that there's a possibility that we're going to run out of money or need money. Well, how can they do that? Well, the original bill, and this wasn't my doing, but the original bill has a provision that contradicts existing law because it mandates the Fed to lend money directly to the Full Employment Trust Fund for the support of the program to make sure that it always has enough money to achieve its goals. And in the current round of provisions, I'm going to propose that there be an additional provision added to that, that the Fed have a continuing duty to cancel that debt if at any point in time any portion or the entirety thereof can be canceled without affirmative harm to the economy. And I like the politics of the way that would work out because the analogy would be, look, they committed, they spent and they created money and or created obligations in the trillions of dollars during the financial crisis to support the banks, were asking them to put themselves in the position, and they thought that it wouldn't harm the economy of committing possibly tens of billions of dollars to a job creation program to make sure that there's always genuine full employment. So I think that there are, and the same could be, you know, how do we solve the Social Security impending funding crisis? Well, one possibility would include that provision. If at any time in the future the Social Security Trust Fund has inadequate funds to pay the current level of benefits, the Fed is hereby mandated to lend and then consider canceling at an appropriate time enough funds to pay for those unfunded benefits. So I think that there are ways of injecting the teaching of modern money theory into what looks otherwise like conventionally funded social welfare benefits.
Yeah, I react to that somewhat. I don't think there is a Social Security funding crisis. I don't think the trust fund matters. It's an accounting artifact. The treasuries that are held by the trust fund are non-marketable in any case. It's an IOU that the government owes to itself. It's just from one pocket to the other. So it's it really doesn't have that much meaning. It may have meaning symbolically, in the sense that...
That's my whole point, that symbolism matters in economics and politics.
Yeah, but you said the funding crisis, so it's you're reinforcing...
Introduce the term perceived in front of it.
That's an important clarification.
And let me interrupt you to ask you to introduce some terms of qualification upon occasion, too.
No, that's fair enough.
Okay. I wasn't going to ask about this, but since it came up, it seems like the New York Times comes up with articles that you have to debunk almost every day. There was the interest on the debt article, and today there is, here's the real story about Social Security, first page of the business section, and it has, you know, it's not as bad as some, but it does have, here's how we can, you know, cure this, and we're going to raise the cap, and which I think, I don't know, I'd be curious, I think it's terrible, I think. What I was going to say is, on the job, first of all, I didn't get your, I don't think you introduced yourself.
I'm Philip Harvey, I teach law at Rutgers.
Okay, I'm Peter Dumowski, I'm a lawyer. And you were talking about how bad it would be to have different versions of the job guarantee, but don't we have that? Isn't there, from what I've read, Booker, the Joe Brand and Sanders models of the job guarantee? And are you, you know, how, if at all, are you working on synthesizing that or presenting that?
I'm hoping that we can get together in the way in which we interact with all of these members of Congress. In the House, there's also the bill that Conyers introduced that is going to be taken over by Frederica Wilson, so that when Bernie inspired members of Congress who've been counseled by MMT theorists enter Congress, they're going to have a decision to make. Are they going to sponsor a different bill in Congress? Or are they going to join H.R. 1000? Are they going to propose a renegotiation of the terms of H.R. 1000? I think that we need to talk about these possibilities in order to ensure that the politics don't get messy. It's possible that these Congress people are in fact talking to everybody. They know that there's conflict, and I don't know whether that's having an effect on the kind of slowdown and the rollout of the various plans, but it's possible that it is. I don't know.
So I wanted to just make a couple comments. I don't know if I'm the only legislator here, but to describe the legislative process a little bit. You're right in some ways that legislation does get changed, and some of the reasons it gets changed is because you have to make compromises, not only with the other side, but with your own side. I've had bills I've introduced where the chair of a committee would come to me and say, I'm not going to hear your bill if you don't listen to what I have to say about this particular thing, or if you don't talk to this lobbyist and hear what they have to say. So another thing that enters into the process is ego. There are many reasons that bills get introduced. To advance your career, for instance, you may introduce a bill, but you know it's not going to go anywhere, but it's something that you can take home, or that other groups that might support you will get behind you, of course. So what I've learned, I guess, is that the most effective strategy for outsiders is to have a clear project or a clear idea that you have, and have large groups and allies support that in a sense, and make that the front page story in a sense, so that if whether it's a legislator that wants to get out in front of that and need it, he has to take what you've got rather than trying to have his own. And I think it's good that there's growing interest and effort to put forward the job guarantee, and I like the frame that MMT is putting on it. So I just wanted to mention that it's in many ways much more complex than it looks from the outside. You bring an idea, you think that it's going to be enacted or whatever, but there are lots of forces that drive that. So just off of that.
Could you introduce yourself?
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm David Bly, state legislator from Minnesota.
Thank you.
I think those are excellent points. I think mentioning ego was important. And there are also reasons that people introduce legislation to box out other people who have similar legislation, because they don't actually want the legislation to all look alike. And that happens and is happening as well. And so sometimes, you know, there are advantages to having a variety of different proposals on the table. If everybody gets on the same page and decides to aim for this in the hopes of ending up here, I guarantee you're not going to end up here. But if you've got someone boldly aiming here, while others are proposing more modest pieces of legislation that are half measures and so forth, then at least you've got somebody who's up here, and that becomes then part of the public debate, and you find out where people want to be. Do they want to be up here? But at least you have made the public option taken off the table. Look what we ended up with, right? Somebody should stand there and say the public option should be one of the ways in which we're thinking about moving forward with healthcare reform. So.
Yay!
Hi, I'm Morris Burr. I spent most of my career structuring GSE securities, but fortunately I now do politics and policy full-time. I think part of the challenge, as you've been describing with the legislators we've talked about, is that we use dollars as both a unit of account and a unit of exchange. They don't even have a way of talking about our abilities except in terms of dollars. Even though the last storm was talked about how many billions of dollars of damage it created, they just say, oh, $1 billion storm. And I think we need to change that in order to be able to express our resources without talking about how many dollars we're talking about. Because as you've been trying to say, the dollars are not the important thing, we just create more of them than we want. But it's a very hard hill to climb with our legislators who are used to talking about things like, you know, their household budget and whatnot. One possibility I've been trying to bring up with some of our readers is that in separating current expenses and capital expenses, saying these things we're spending money on, but these other things like roads and bridges and hospitals and whatever, are things that we're not spending money on, we're transforming dollars into hospitals or whatever else we need to have things. So I think that might be a sort of a viable half, quarter, kind of a step in the right direction.
Well, I think the current budgeting rules actually are very challenging to interpret money and dollars in the way that, you know, majority of people here think they really should be interpreted as. Just like every bill gets, you know, a CBO score, right? Which, or, you know, there's a publication of a budget both by OMB and CBO about like what the deficit is likely to be. Like, it's sort of ingrained in how we think about things. And there's also another thing, which was there was the Federal Budget Reform Act, which was done a fair long, you know, a few decades ago, whose job is to think about, for example, on student loans, it's not just the money that's going out, but the net present value of the money that's supposed to be coming in. I think the Department of Agriculture and their lending programs, and it's very strange to think about that, right? Like from our perspective, that they did those rules because they wanted to show that money going out the door would be, you know, balanced out by money coming in. Like these sort of basic mechanisms of how we report like deficits and primary deficits and so on. But that's what I agree with you. There should be. I don't know if your way is necessarily the best way, but you have to. I think it's really important to take a very good look at it. Otherwise, people just keep waving that as like a flag, right? To shoot down any proposal that you have. So I think it makes sense to take a really good look at it.
I would love to hear your thoughts. I'll try to tee you up so that you can handle this one, because this idea has been around forever. Economists like Bob Eisner and post-Keynesian economists have pushed this idea of capital budgeting for a very long time. I personally view it as a gimmick. It's just a way to say, it's not as bad as you think it is. If we just account for it in this way, more like a business, write off an expense over a period of years, then we can demonstrate that it's not all that much spending all, and the numbers can be finagled in a way that makes it appear like less scary for the public. But since I'm trying to come at this from an MMT perspective and just completely persuade people that, when the government does budgeting, it should do so with aims and missions in mind. What are the goals? What is it you're trying to achieve with your budget? So I'll channel Mario Matsukato, and I'll say, she talks about mission-oriented finance. Well, I just talk about mission-oriented budgeting. What is it that your budget is trying to do? But the Freedom Budget was very clear in the 1960s. They lay this thing out and say, we are putting this budget together for the purpose of eliminating poverty in 10 years' time. No one in America will be poor in 10 years' time. And that's the justification for why the budget is written the way it is. So tell us what it is you're trying to accomplish with your budget, and then instruct CBO to provide useful feedback on legislation and on budget through the budgeting process. So right now we give CBO the budget and they send out the score, and all anyone pays attention to is how much is it at the deficit and what does it do to the long-term debt trajectory. This is the least useful information and feedback they could possibly provide you with, right? So if we had a CBO in the 1930s and in the 1960s, we wouldn't have Social Security or Medicare, because it never would have scored, right? It wouldn't have costed out. So we've got to, I think, look at ways to get the budget committee, if we have the right people on the budget committee. The CDO works for the budget committee. They're a creature of Congress. They were created along with the budget committees. They can be told to change the information, the way that they're reporting information, what they're examining. Tell us what the inflationary effect of doing $1 trillion of infrastructure over the next 5 years would be. Right? Tell us how many children we lifted out of poverty if we expand the earned income tax credit in the proposed way. Tell us, right? Give us
interesting feedback. You're almost proposing in a way, instead of thinking about it from a CBO scoring perspective, almost how GAO evaluates like the success of programs and achieving
the likelihood of achieving. What are the goals of this legislation? What are the what are the climate implications of this legislation? What are the implications for the Gini coefficient? What is going to happen if we break? Tell us some, give us some useful guidelines so that we can make a vote based on.
So, strictly speaking, from an NFP standpoint, the dollars are the dollars we need to spend it on current consumption items, consumables, or on capital items. And that's true, because you can't see any interconnectedness of problems.
Right?
Speaking
to another
one. So there's an interesting interconnectedness of problems here with respect to the idea of a capital budget and whether it really matters from a strict M&T standpoint, pointed out a moment ago, you might not have heard, whether it's expenditure on consumables or on capital items, it doesn't really matter. The dollars are originating in the same place, and if it makes sense to spend the dollars, we'll find the money to do it, we'll create it. But, this idea about linking plans to budgets, and old public administrationists back in the 1960s, named Harold Seidman, who spent many, many years at the Bureau of the Budget in London, OMB, basically said linking plans to budgets is the public administration equivalent of the search for the philosopher's stone. It's very hard. And I think it's hard because we don't have the right kind of conceptual equipment. So let me give you an example of what I mean. When I talk to my students about public expenditure, I say, look, think in these terms. We are in another fight for national survival. It's World War II all over again. Do you not think that we would expend and do whatever it took in order to prevail in that struggle? And they go, of course. Even if everyone knew, including all the defense contractors, there wasn't any money in the trade. It was all being created as we needed it. The money calls into exist production, and it commands labor, and all these things happen. And we have enough material and enough men at arms in order to prevail, and we win. Now let's take a step back. Suppose we were to decide as a society, broad democratic consensus, that having a healthy, well-educated workforce were in our national security interest, do you not think that we would spend anything that we needed to in order to make it happen? And they said, well, of course, but how do you know? And I said, well, there's the rub. We actually do not have, and I think we should put some real hard thinking against developing a coherent theory of investment in human capital. We just don't have it. We need that justification. With some rationale for having a capital budget that also included as a key element investment in human capital. And I think that might actually score a lot of political points. You know, then you could talk coherently about a free higher education for everybody. You could talk about universal health care and a lot of other things if we actually had something that we could fall back upon instead of falling back on, well, how are we going to pay for it?
Hi, my name is Ethan Ubell. I really like that point that you just made, because my question is about the struggles that politicians, even those who are sympathetic to the MMT outlook and advise, are still having with articulating a vision for a country and a world that is sort of governed by these principles. I'm wondering if in the conversation some of you may have had with politicians, how they're developing ways to actually develop messages to campaign on that could actually work in the context of the current environment of national campaigning, where things are very hostile. People have already discussed, how difficult it is, but changing that view to speak without having to explain all of the sort of superstructure of MMT that's being developed, but rather come up with a way that sort of gets to a talking point that people can glom onto without understanding everything beforehand. And I think what you just said.
Sorry, just before you answer, just a heads up, we'll be having a panel later on this afternoon in here on electoral politics in particular, so feel free to answer, but we'll get into that in a little more detail.
If I could carry over something that was discussed in the session on law preceding this one. In the 1930s and 40s, the answer to that question was, we frame it as a human right. And in fact, it was more difficult to do that at that time because there wasn't at that time the international legal system, as weak as it is, recognizing those rights, and it was largely because of the insistence of American progressives that economic and social entitlements be perceived as rights that international law changed and came to officially recognize a right to a job, a right to a decent income, and so forth, as fundamental human rights on a par with the right to freedom of speech and those other things. Now, progressives essentially abandoned that rhetoric at the end of the World War II, picked it up, but only in the context of discrimination in the 60s and 70s. But it's lying there in international law, waiting to be repatriated. Thanks to Eleanor Roosevelt, it got deposited in international law. We can bring it back to the United States, but it would take time, and it would take commitment. Roosevelt worked on it for his entire two administrations, before he was at the point that there was widespread public acceptance of it. It was only in the context of the war effort when all sacrifices are deemed appropriate. But it still provides an additional framing to all of the good utilitarian, economic, self-interested reasons why it would be in the country's interest to make these kinds of investments.
Hi, Harry Pector, publisher of Retirement Income Journal. So far we've been talking about this mandate as a battle of ideas. but it's also, as we all know, it's a battle of interest. And at some point, as a country or as a government or whoever did it, we outsourced a lot of the financial money creation and credit creation to the private sector. And that private sector is huge, entrenched, and has incredible self-interest that it protects. We know that, but this is not possible. We know that, like, what we're up against here. But they're not going to give up this just because of their power and their money, just because a light bulb goes on and says, oh, I get an MT. I mean, that's not going to make the interest go away. But anyway, but I did have a specific question about the panelists who mentioned that the other side is in there talking to the Treasury Department. And I wondered who the other side
Let me clarify that. I don't mean that there was the other, when I said people who, let's say, might not have progressive sympathies, right? Or you honestly effectively like the private sector, right? Or parts of financial markets that may not necessarily be aligned with how people in this room are thinking. And what I mean by that is they're not, there's no specific meetings or anything. It's that they publish and they hold think tank seminars, and they, when people leave government, oftentimes they end up working there and then they come back. So there is this sort of process that's well entrenched, at least from my observation in Washington, where you sort of develop a fairly substantial sort of cadre of individuals who, once they're back in the policymaking roles, ideologically aligned in a way that you probably wouldn't be.
Are you talking about the former Mercatus Center who might?
No, I'll say Cato Heritage Institute.
Right.
Yeah. Like those would be places that are prolific publishers that have deep roots in the policymaking community, not necessarily Treasury, but you know, on the Hill. I'm not sure how much you ran into them, but.
Oh, yeah, they're CBO.
Yeah, I mean, like, yeah, so, like, yeah.
Well,
so,
yeah, they represent.
I don't see, yeah. The, my feeling is today we don't have a very good brick and mortar response to that yet.
Yeah, exactly. Well, it's very well funded and it's very powerful, and we don't have that.
Yeah.
In the interest of time, can we get the last two questions over here together? And then we'll get the panel to answer one last question here, and then I've got one question right on the side. So two more batches of two. So
Hi. I have a question about the deficit that comes up in my mind whenever MIT talks about the deficit. I'm Sue Peters, I'm from the American Monetary Institute. I worked for 15 years for one of the largest multinational banks that have power over our Congress, with the power they have to create money when they make loans and decide who gives it to. So that's a power they wield on Congress. So when it comes to the deficit, and I've tried to study the Federal Reserve for many years, they make it difficult. But my understanding is this. The deficit is debt being sold into the public, but all of that debt, a good part, 95%, is first bought by private multinational banks called primary dealers at the New York Fed. And they're the same people who do open market operations. They are making money off of every single bond that is sold by our Treasury. And not only that, but they get to hold that Treasury and wield the power of those Treasuries internationally. And the other thing, and this took me many years to understand about private commercial banks, not only do they create money when they make a loan by putting the deposit in the borrower's account, but I was shocked to find out that when a private commercial bank, like J.P. Morgan Chase, who's one of the primary dealers, when it goes to buy that treasury from a treasury bond from our treasury, they create the money. They have the power in the Federal Reserve law to create the money to buy our debt. Now that is a power that we, that's why they're so powerful in Congress. So I need MMT to speak to that.
Nick?
So I just want to speak to that just a little bit. Look, I don't, there's a little, so like, I understand your point. Is anyone who has a bank account can directly apply to treasury auctions. Not a lot of people do because it's a little bit of a hassle and they have to go to treasury for everything. That infrastructure is great. The primary dealer system was set up a long, long time ago. But you know, fairly recently, maybe 10 or 15 years ago, individuals could directly buy at auctions. I don't know necessarily why you want to, but you could do it. Even non-bank investors or investment firms, if they want to, can try to involve themselves in auctions. So I think the model you're speaking of, you know, a long, long time ago when the market was less liquid and less structured, the Treasury Department had these, not the Treasury, sorry, the Federal Reserve, had these primary dealers. If you read the description, it was first and foremost to be a counterparty of the New York Fed. And to trade with the New York Fed. But just to be clear, like anyone here got a bank account, you can apply to buy a treasury bond.
So,
do they create the money to buy the treasury bonds?
Well, it's a good point. I mean, I've lived in a world where we just have excess reserves. So they basically have money almost always at the Fed. So yeah, their transactions take place at the Fed where they'll apply in the treasury auctions, they'll receive the bonds, and then that's credited to their account, and you know, whatever reserves they have will go down. But there are overdraft mechanisms there for banks. Those are very expensive overdraft mechanisms, and they have a charge for them. I remember reading it a while ago.
There's also, just to jump on, there's also the historically the Treasury tax and money account system was set up as a way of smoothing reserve drains and adds into the reserve system when, you know, during periods of tax from payroll receipts and things like that. And that system meant that a lot of tax receipts stayed within the banking system. And if payments were made for, you know, to buy treasuries and things that came out of those, it would look like they're coming in to create reserves. But I think what Amal's point is, correct me if I'm wrong, is that ultimately treasury payments, payments to buy treasuries by banks clear at the reserve settlement level, and only if there was a net clearing of other deposits and things would that not show up there. Otherwise, it has to be set at the reserves.
Far more.
The other shibboleth is, is crowding out investment. That the deficit is going to crowd out private investment and slow economic growth in the future. That's what's so horrible about it's one of the things that's so horrible about a long-term big deficit. And I, progressive think tanks repeat this. Nancy Pelosi folks that all repeat this. It is universally.
Paul Krugman.
It's just a question of whether they emphasize it or not, but they all believe it. Dean Baker believes it. He doesn't emphasize it, but he believes it. Can you comment on what we do about that?
What we do is, we've done it now for 20 plus years, and part of the MMT project is to attack directly this idea that government deficits drive up interest rates. And this was the subject of one of my early papers, was to demonstrate that precisely the opposite is what happens, that government deficits push interest rates down. And if the Fed doesn't intervene to keep interest rates in positive territory, then under normal circumstances, the overnight interest rate will settle at zero. And so deficits push rates down, not up. It's the Fed that keeps rates above what Warren has called the natural rate, which would be zero otherwise. And the deficits themselves are a source of net financial assets to the non-government part of the economy. So far from crowding out some finite pool of dollars that's available, government deficits increase the size of the pot, if you like. Right? They add net financial assets. So they increase the amount of money. They don't take away limited finite resources in competition with private borrowers driving up interest rates. So the story is completely backwards. And I don't know how much more we can say or do or write or explain, but It's a, we've explained it. Some people are slow on the update.
Last question, please, Jane, on the floor.
My name is Rebecca Spang. I'm a history professor at IU and one of Bob Krafcik's colleagues. I'm thinking about all of this and about the point Sue raised, and it feels to me that there are a couple of very fundamental things that university students, maybe high school students, legislators, they don't have in their vocabulary, it feels like, the language of the public. The public is always just imagined as a bigger private. And that simply is not what public means. And you see the whole idea of publicness under so much pressure right now, whether it's public higher ed, whether it's sort of public spaces all being privatized, public transport, Uber for this, Uber for that. And it feels to me that that's where a lot of energy and work with the idea of the public good, which, I mean, who could be against the public good? But I think this does connect to the point that Sue made. I think it's very powerful for people to realize, and this is sort of a basic and metaphor point, private commercial banks produce money. It's not that the Fed is printing it, right? It's that when they lend onto somebody's balance sheet, boom, there's the money. And so that logic is just so scary because people still imagine that banks lend from their reserves, which, you know, is not what happens. So those sort of basic lessons, I think, are, so one is about changing the vocabulary, have the idea in public, but the other is to sort of get away from this vision that people have that either the public or private sector banks operate like a household.
I think, okay, I'm going to say several things. First, I'm writing my hand. First, you almost hired my husband 2 years ago, and had you done so, I may have ended up in his department.
Oh my gosh.
Which could have been kind of cool. But I'll explain the story in a later time. Anne is right, but Anne is focused on private banking. And this is well known among post-Keynesian economists and MMT economists and Dodgins money, all that stuff. Yes, banks don't lend other people's money. That's not how banking works. That's fine, but set that aside because that's not the purpose of talking about public money.
Right.
There is public money. And MMT will often talk in terms of public money for public purpose. We use the phrase public purpose, but you could just as easily substitute the public good. Right? So yes, we've gotten way far away from a time where we talked about the public good or public goods. And so even when we talk about education, we use terms like human capital. Right? It's about you investing in your human kids so you can compete and be competitive and all that kind of stuff. No, education is a public good, but we've gotten away from that. And so we're all operating in Thatcher's brand, right? There is no public money, there is only taxpayer money. And once you accept that framing, then the whole thing devolves into a fight over who's going to pay for it, and that then takes you to whose taxes are going up in order to fund this thing that is a public good, but we don't call it a public good.
I'd just like to make a plug that the theme of this conference is public money, public purpose, public power.
Sanjeev,
last question, then we'll call it quits.
Hi, I'm Sanjeev. I used to be a bond trader, and I'm doing a religious. What was the exogenous event, and have you built a countercyclical fiscal policy since then? That was one question. Second was, I guess it's Bob. Bob, I'm not an economist, so I'm sure this will be back to the way before. What is valuation of given gap? I'm not sure those would be the exact words, but it's sort of starting to come together. Yesterday, the cost of care, the cost of education. You know, the government, the social welfare state, has invested in people. So the question then is, why is it so wrong to have a minimum wage if capitalism wants to pay somebody $7 an hour and we invest way more than that? That amounts to a job guaranteed minimum wage. I think Dappleton should pay for those externalities. They're not. So that's just a thought. And I'd love to know your response to that. Or you.
Thank you for the question. Yeah, we are actually in the process of building a sustainable counter-cyclical policy framework against those of exogenous shocks. But one of the key elements is, of course, fiscal side. We had a parliament approved the fiscal stabilization law 8 years ago. But one of the key weaknesses of that law was actually legalized the public debt to GDP. It put a hard ceiling, hard limit on that ratio, about 60%. And the government is under enforcement to go down that ratio towards 40. But public debt to GDP is actually the phenomenon of balance of payments, especially in developing countries with currency is not convertible. So if the balance of payments performs well, debt automatically reduces and vice versa, right? So still we are in the learning process for establishing that sort of concept. But another thing of the weakness of orthodox and traditional policies is that central banks' authorities and power, and they function only targets price stability, and there's no single objective or the target for the full employment. And then politicians and half-educated people, they try to abolish the central bank's function, the role in the job market, the labor market. So that's actually very challenging in developing countries like Mongolia.
I don't know what would be the right policy approach to internalize some of those external costs. I don't know. There's probably a whole array of alternatives that want to be looked at. I happen to like the idea of a universal job guarantee, especially when I'm looking at what might be coming down the pike in terms of robotics and all. There was, you know, Phil, you may remember this, a New York Times front page article about a year ago that had some frightening statistics in it. We're talking about maybe 300 million people worldwide in the next 10 years losing their employment due to robotics. Perhaps as many as 80 million in America. That's got to be some very enormous portion of our labor force. So I'm just wondering if we aren't on the verge of a robotics revolution where maybe 20% of the workers will produce all the goods and services the other 80% need. What does the other 80% do to support themselves? That would be an enormous transformation of the economy as we know it. I have no idea what that future looks like. Maybe Star Trek or something. You know? The only people that seem to be employed are Starfleet. Everybody else is running around having fun. There's no such thing as money. They loosely refer to something called credits, but it's in only a couple of different episodes. And I'm just, wow. You know, and who knows? But something. I think this is going to be forced upon us before we know it. And I'm afraid it might be forced upon us before we're really prepared for it.
Stephen Hawking gives us 100 years, so.
Sorry, what was that?
He said Stephen Hawking gives us 100 years. That's the latest.
I'd also.
100 years to get off the planet.
They better start making seawalls around lower Manhattan.
Yeah, that's right. If we can stop the planet burning and make sure every child has a good education and a lot of home and care first, maybe then we can talk about not having any work to do.
Yeah.
I think the conversation we ended yesterday was a pretty good indication of what we can really focus on is radically transforming, expanding the idea of valuable work that you're remunerating. We can start there to go beyond the widget making definition of work to something more expensive. But we have more powers on that later on today. And as I said, we addressed a step over last yesterday as well. I encourage people to check out if they haven't. We're going to break for lunch now. Thank you for your patience. Thank you for your power. You're going to try and start back up at 1:30 to get back on time. So please, I'm sorry, that this is time at lunch. There'll also be another MOT Primus 101 session over in the street meeting over on Fifth Avenue right now during lunch if you want to.
Contradict what you said?
Hey! Nice to see you.
I'm sorry, it's kind of, so I think what they're actually right about is that they would have a disproportionate amount of power in Washington generally, but that's basically all moneyed interests, not just the banks. If anything, they spent the last 15 years trying to weaken the primary dealer's ability to So, for example, the idea that any one of us can get a bank account that that can buy bonds was like a way to try to democratize that system a little bit more. So they've tried, but that's a
little.
No. Some of them are actually. It's like, for example, Jefferson's, which is not a big bank. If you're going to be a big bank, you might as well be a primary dealer.
The important point here was that she said that banks create money the same way they create loans when they buy treasuries, and you said that they buy treasuries with excess.
Right now,
she's saying that contradicts what she said. So she.
Well, I mean, so they have excess reserves. That's the thing. And all the accounts sort of clear there, right? So. Well, it's a good question where on their account, on the balance sheet, it comes out of. Are they selling one set of loans to buy the treasuries? Or are they debiting their excess reserves? I've seen it vary. I've asked a number of people before.
Well, to me, that is exactly where the rubber meets the road on all of this.
Make them off.
What
off
the bank yeah, no worries, buy the treasuries with? Did they invent the money? Did they take the money from the inflation? Just to teach me that before every single.
I think it's a very interesting question.
It's well, it's
at the atomic level. But the thing is, what happens if the answer varies?
Well, that's a problem with all of them. Because we have many ways of creating debt. We have many ways of creating
credit. So if you think about something like Credit Suisse, right, which has a U.S. branch, but is still an international bank with the majority of its business and assets operating outside of the United States in non-dollar jurisdictions, like what would be the accounting of that? I'm not sure.
No, I didn't recommend a book. I didn't know if you wrote something that could go to
An investment bank, though, when it gathers money for raises money for, say, a nuclear reactor in some other country, they are actually taking investor money. They're not inventing that money.
Well,
right?
So
that's a different animal.
So there's, for example, there's investment banks that don't have accounts at the Fed.
They have to raise money.
So
right?
that's the repo market, right? So they will literally borrow money that's pledged against the securities.
Oh, I thought they went out and got the insurance companies to buy.
No. Sometimes they do, but other times the repo market is like the grease that functions behind all of this. If I don't have the cash on hand or the reserves on hand, I borrow via repo and I pledge my securities against it.
Oh, and so they can finance anything for a small amount.
Trillions, it rolls like a couple of trillion roll every night.
And then how much are they getting paid on this?
On the repos? They have to pay for the financing.
They pay for the financing, but then they make money on the sale of the distribution.
Yeah. Generally what happens is whatever you're borrowing in repo is going to be less in the fee than you would in terms of the interest of the security.
Oh, so the cost of it is meaningless. So, I mean, it's built
it's healthy,
in.
But
it's,
like,
it's just a piece of that.
Yeah, so it's a good question is how much in the Treasury curve is built in the cost of financing, which is a big academic question.
Ah, to me, this is the holy grail. This is where it happens.
Good remarks.
Oh, thanks. Oh,
very good.
I was off today. I think it was probably beers last night.
And what's your name again?
Amara. It's good to meet you.
And you used to work for the Treasury.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm a lawyer. I'm a professional lawyer. I know a lot. By this point, I know a lot about this stuff. There's, I learn every time. I'm really glad I came all the way from Albany.
Right. Oh, this is a great town, though.
It's a good town.
Well, there's a guy named Frederick Sutton.
I've gotten to be friendly with several of these folks.
Yes, he wrote about this a long time ago. In
Oregon.
And his book, yeah, I like some of it. Obviously, Rowan is about the bank. Sunbeam there.
Where do you work now?
I work for him.
Because he's an engine. He wasn't a financial
guy. No, they have nothing to do with me being down here.
My wife has her boss.
Yes.
It's an old firm.
Well, very interesting.
Well, I'll be in the afternoon panel if you're interested.
Yeah. Which one?
Mark Knudsen
starts out.
Mark Knudsen.
What is the problem? We have plenty of resources. We keep everybody in food, shelter. Why are we doing that?
The three of
and yeah. We have a monopoly that creates our electricity and charges a fees for what?
Oh, that's one.
It should be actually.
Well, you better not this. No.
And sometimes I compare it to the diamond diamonds
are just comments about how
there's a massive
built
an artificially scarce and charge a lot of money for them.
Oh, I'm sorry for interrupting. So I just wanted to thank you for being here right now.
There was last year's conference
a little differently, and I appreciate you coming here. Yeah. Like, I think like most presentations assume that the audience is already like
watching. I mean, it's factual stuff,
but if you wanted to,
I've become friendly with that.
What do you doing lunch?
Oh yeah,
he was former undersecretary. Get more of the guys that
we were getting together.
He's the only from New York. I've heard,
and I was hoping to see him.
Yeah, I was hoping to
meet him.
Yeah,
but he's great. Right down.
But he's
that.
All right.
Are you still at the Treasury?
Yeah. Well, no. When the baby gets, the egg gets fertilized. And, now, how do I get a hold of you?
No, I was at the line.
Say, I'm a.
Oh, sorry.
Gather
Yeah, I can give you my email address. By the way, I know you're a publisher, but you're not going to publish anything after this, right? Because it's Chatham House, and I have to clear things if I make public statements, if that makes any sense.
Oh, well, I'm going to talk to you before I make any public statements.
So my email address is Reganti, R-E-G-A-N-T-I, .amar.
Wait, is the T before the N?
You mean to
I appreciate what you have to say about the...
No, it's I literally can't make them comments to the press.
No, I didn't have anything to say.
Oh, thank you.
But if you ever have questions or thoughts, you want to
talk it out on the stage.
Oh, so that's right. Amari.
It's kind of like a 30 little secret defense. Federal by Treasury debt.
I cover a lot of financial.
Primary dealer system. The dealers have inventory. They put inventory to Fed. Fed gives them reserves. So as long as it's Fed Treasuries and primary dealers, all the bonds get sold for the government. And it's a self-dealing system. They're in the system. They're in with the government.
They empower them because
they feel that they own
the governments need them to play the game that they're playing at this time.
I think you'd be surprised with you 100%. More markets people.
Whether we could reduce their power, that's a question.
Well, they, but in terms of
everyone in the government isn't aware of what the power structures are.
Oh, but you know, like
people in Fed are aware of it. Some people in the Treasury are aware.
He used to be at PIMCO. Very, very
Congress isn't totally aware of it.
He teaches Ronin's
politically.
He's been interviewed by Stephanie in the New York Times.
You know, it's such a powerful system because it helps them spend money on whatever they want. It helps them sell the bonds.
But that's what I see it as.
Right, and the job guarantee doesn't get done, and the little guy doesn't.
This is not be that big.
And the thing that bothers me is, well, you were in the big banking system when I studied law.
It's what I call
economists and lawyers call it agency problems. I don't know if you're familiar with the theory. It's that the executives can capture the company, capture the government, put money in their pocket. Shift the risk to the government.
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. But, you know, I do wonder, like, I don't think
these are problems that are hard to go away.
Right? Like,
the little guy doesn't get it.
Well, they think mainly about sales.
Yeah. So, like, yes, that's like, yeah, they go home and ask that. Like,
social justice.
Like, I think the interesting thing about this is, like, the questions you're asking.
They capture the government and they look at the little guy. If you go bankrupt and you're a little guy, we're all irresponsible. We're in bed with the government, so we can't.
You've seen that.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying?
I was with it.
Which is the cleanest.
Yeah. Were you down in Radnor?
Yeah.
I literally almost went there. I was interviewing there and other places.
And they're going to their research, like the Steve Austin.
No, I was going to go. I was going to go to the other spot.
And you can see the history.
That's right. Didn't know about bond markets and so on.
Well, when I was there, Vanguard was a very strange place.
You get smart creative money.
They're really nice people.
Oh, they're nice, but they tend to
be
like
struggle the whole history of our
people who are.
I heard you have to earn your
The world we live in is, if we don't do it, UK banks will do it. So that's what happened before the crisis. I think Paulson was in Goldman Sachs. They lobbied Congress to say, get rid of some regulations because we can't compete with the UK banks.
There's
got rid of regulations
people,
and then,
12 people around.
I don't know if that blew up the economy or other things going on.
Yeah.
The idea is banks should be regulated because they're essentially creating money that's off balance sheet liability of the government.
It's not a good place for creation. They don't have interesting projects.
Kucinich, I know where I am.
Projects which not to make, ever make a mistake.
Yes.
And to run everything at cost. And that's all they do. They don't want to buy an insurance company. They don't want to go public. They don't want to. They're a back office operation.
I got a front row.
Do you have a card or something?
Okay, whatever you need. Okay, thank you.
You're welcome.
I appreciate it.
I'm glad that I didn't stay. I'm going to try to get some
Yeah.